Welcome to Radio Tabule, fresh content west of the Middle East, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Levantine Cultural Center. Based in Los Angeles, the center promotes a greater understanding of the Middle East and North Africa with artistic and educational programs that bridge political and religious divides. This week's podcast features a discussion between Professors Dr. Nubar Hovsepian, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Studies at Chapman University, editor of the book called The War on Lebanon, and Dr. Gabriel Peterberg, author most recently of a book called The Returns of Zionism, Myths, Politics, and Scholarship in Israel. Dr. Peterberg also writes for the New Left Review and the London Review of Books. His program, entitled Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, a Levantine Conversation on the Future of the Region, intended to encourage intellectual discussion surrounding the history and present political landscape in which Palestinians, Israelis, and Lebanese find themselves. Here, Gabby Peterberg talks about his trip in northern Israel during the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon.
The thing I remember most with which I start my piece is that as I was driving to Kiryat Shmona in the north of Israel, my cell phone kept ringing all the time, incessantly. And on the other side of course, all the time, my mother was asking the same question, do you think that either Jews or Arabs are worth dying for? And I kept thinking about the brilliant Woody Allen line, which he says that he was raised by a castrated Zionist mother. And so, to the book itself, what I want to do is say very briefly a few things about the book, but then how, in my view, it relates to the present. And the book is something I wanted. I'm originally a historian of the Ottoman Empire, but because I have this political bug or commitment, and I say this openly, I used to say, you know, to justice, which I am, and to peace, which I am, but more than anything, I'm committed to the Palestinian people. That made me relinquish for a while, or for maybe longer than just a while, the Ottoman work that I normally would do and for which I was trained to, and write this book, which, as I say, I had wanted to write for a while. And in addition to this, it's also a debt to Edward Said. And it's one of these things that we all knew that he would die because of his illness. It was a matter of when, not whether. But his death was such a shock that it somehow propelled me into delving into this and writing the book. Now, the book is a scholarly book. I have to tell you, I don't, although I should probably do this as a not very good salesman that I am. It's a heavy scholarly book. Basically, it is an intellectual and literary history of Zionism and the State of Israel, in which what generally I'm trying to say is that it should be understood within the context of comparative settler colonialism, on which I shall say a word in a minute. And what I do is explore things that fall within what I think should be the framework, although it's not a comparative book, I don't compare it. This is something that I want to do as my next book, but it's an attempt to show that this, there's no other way to understand this. And my guiding light was Edward Said's chapter in his The Question of Palestine. What I learned from that chapter is how to write about Zionism. My book is not about Palestinians directly. It's about Zionism, and it's about Zionists and Israelis. But how to write this with the victims of this project all the time in mind. And in that sense, it's a book directly about Zionism and Israel, but it is about Zionism and Israel as a settler project, which of necessity brings in the indigenous Arab people of Palestine, because that's what settlers mean. And I explore things like, for instance, the use of the Bible, the Old Testament, I should say more precisely, by Zionists and Israelis in order to legitimate and motivate their project. I look at literature as reflecting settler literary imagination, which is something I'm pursuing further now, and so on and so forth. And I've organized, which is, by the way, you're all encouraged to attend, but tomorrow, as it were, tomorrow and Friday, there's a conference I've organized at UCLA with very good people, which is called Invasion in a Structure, Not an Event, Comparative Settler Colonialism, Past and Present, and it's precisely about what I want to say right now. So let me say a word about settler colonialism very quickly, and then why I think it's past and present, why it is a structure, not an event, why is it ongoing? It's not only an origination, it is very relevant to what's happening now, and why I think there's not going to be any solution. Settler colonialism is a phenomenon that goes, is as old as colonialism, basically, which is the expansion of white Europe, beginning in 1500s on. Now, colonialism has been known to everyone for a long time, and everyone knows what it is, but what many people have not paid attention to, and it's become a burgeoning scholarly field in the last decade or two, is that there are two types of colonialism. One is the more familiar one, which a European country took over, conquered another non-European, non-white country, and ruled it, exploited it directly with its own administration and colonial army. At some point, it was driven out, left, driven out, or combination of both. The other type, though, which could happen, not only could, did happen simultaneously, is that some of these projects, which are more famous, like British India, and it's probably the most obvious example, but there are, of course, many others, is that some of these projects were accompanied by white immigrants from the mother countries, the metropolitan conquering countries, who not only came, or not didn't come at all as part of the administration and the army, but came in order to settle in these newly acquired colonies, and with time to establish in them their own national patrimony that they claim via, again, of necessity, dispossessing the natives of their land and not infrequently of their lives. This was also accompanied usually, or on many occasions I should say, by a showdown with the metropolitan force, the metropolitan colonial power, in which, if the settler project was successful and this became a nation state, the metropolitan power was driven out. If it was not successful, the settlers lost and usually had to leave. Now, the successful, I say, from a settler point of view, also Bin Laden. You will think that I think that this was successful in any objective way. Are, of course, the US, which is the greatest and most obvious example of a settler colonial project that succeeded and became a nation state, Canada, Argentina, Australia, South Africa, Israel, and New Zealand. And there were cases where the settlers failed and eventually were driven out. French Algeria is the more famous case. British Kenya, in which Kenya won independence, Algeria won independence, doesn't mean that independence brought heaven on earth. It usually, alas, did not. But these are the cases. Now, what I'm saying is, in general, is that Israel-Palestine falls within this comparative framework, and that the idea of comparing is to gain insights. It's not to say that all the cases are identical, on the contrary. Most of these studies end up seeing the specific historical trajectory of each case. What Israel shares with similar cases like the north part of the US, not the south, the northern part of the US, Australia, is the two main examples, perhaps Argentina to some extent, but mainly Australia and the north of the US, is that it's a type of settler colonialism that is called pure settlement colony. Now, what is it? It is a project in which the idea is to create, which doesn't mean that it begins with that idea, but that's how it develops, to create a white-only settlement, which becomes a nation state with time, in which the indigenous are not wanted for their labor. The only thing that is wanted from the indigenous is their land, not their labor. The idea is to create a white labor only colony, which then becomes a state, in which everything is done by the white immigrants or the white settlers. Now, this is the most rapacious and the most violent type of settler colonialism, not because of the other types are wonderfully ethical, but because of the objective land labor formation. From that point of view, the indigenous people are the ones who become superfluous. Because what is wanted, again, from a settler's point of view, is their land, not their labor. And this has been the story of Zionism, with a certain hiatus at the beginning of the project, which stopped after two decades, and with another brief hiatus from, say, the 1970s, the mid-1970s, to the outbreak of the First Intifada, when Palestinians were exploited but from the occupied territories, but were nonetheless employed in the Israeli economy. Other than that, it's exactly like the way the north of the US developed, Canada and Australia. In those cases, it led to almost the complete extermination of the indigenous people. And if not their complete extermination literally, at least to their elimination as a political presence. So there might be discussions here about the Native Americans, of course there are, once in a while it comes up, or the Aborigines, the Aborigines in Australia, but they are not a challenge to the sovereignty of the white settler project. It might be a problem in reservations, of minority, of ethnic things, of casinos here and so forth, but they are not. The uniqueness within the framework of the Israeli-Palestinian case is that the settlers in the Zionist case failed to eliminate the presence of the indigenous. They gave it their best shot in 48, a more limited shot in 67, and they're still trying in various ways, which I should talk about in a second, but on the whole they failed. In other words, they failed to remove irrevocably the indigenous people from the territory which they deemed their national patrimony. Now, the fact that they are still there is the reason that we have an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Otherwise, we would have an Israel that looks more like Australia or the US, which to some extent it does, but in other significant ways it doesn't, because at least partially there is a challenge to its sovereignty, in the sense that there are enough indigenous people who are completely powerless and defeated, but nonetheless have some sort of claim which is significant of sovereignty. Now, I want now to jump, tell you why I think that this is not only important as a historical analysis, but also to understand how the past spills into the present and is still significant, not only in Israel-Palestine, but we are talking about that particular case, and that is because these states continue to behave as if they were settler projects, not as if they were sovereign states with at least some universal pretension. What does universal pretension, or even better, a real genuine intention and practices and institutions and laws would mean? It would mean creating an entity, okay, it has a certain history, it was created in a certain way, which is painful and violent, and many states have one sort or another of violent history of creation, but once it is created, the state behaves as if it is the state of and for its citizens. The state of Israel is a particularly hard case because it's being challenged. Not because it's worse than US and Australia, in my view. It's not better, but it's not worse. But because it's being challenged, in which it is a state that is explicitly, not implicitly like forms of racism here or in Australia, it is explicitly a state that is based on Judeo supremacy, meaning on settler supremacy. And it is something that keeps not only going, it keeps evolving, because the state has more power and the people whom it rules, who are not Jews, are more powerless. And it's true not only in the occupied territories, which is the easy, quote-unquote, easy case, it goes on within the Green Line itself. And you can see it in several domains. I'll point out to you just a few. The first is laws that constantly and with growing ferocity create or try to create a racially pure settler society or community, which is clearly distinguishable from the indigenous society, and no mixing is possible. It is increasingly impossible, it has always been, and not only through legal means, also through social, educational, cultural means, for Jews to marry Arabs. It's literally impossible, both within the green line and without the green line, and the laws that, I don't know how many of you follow, but the laws that have been promulgated in the past 5 to 10 years, especially since the outbreak of the Second Intifada, are basically resembling urine laws, in which it's increasingly difficult to be a non-Jew in a Jewish state. In the occupied territories, again, for sure, there's no question about that, but also within the Green Line, where the Arabs are supposed to be citizens of the state, equal citizens, which they, by definition, do not. And this is an important distinction, because here there might be, say, anti-black racism, but there is a certain constitutional framework that leaves a very small, admittedly, but a very small leverage of struggle on universal grounds. The Israeli law makes it impossible. You cannot, if the state itself declares itself, basically they would accept my terms, of course, but as a state that is in its laws and in its equivalent of constitution supposed to perpetuate for eternity Judeo supremacy, there is no way you can argue in court or in other state agencies, try to get equality by universalist claims. Because by definition, the laws are not universal. They're ethnocentric. So that is one way in which the community of settlers, which of course controls its state, it's its own state, is still behaving as a settler project, as a project that is trying to preserve the racial purity and majority, of course, of the settler community, who happens in this particular case to be Jews. So when I say Judeo supremacy, I don't mean anything general about Judaism as if it has any inherent tendency and such, although we can discuss that too, but as historically concrete to this particular case of settler colonialism. The other domain is land, in which, again, the state continues to behave, and not only in the occupied territories, as a project that is trying to gain more land for Jews and less land, if possible, no land at all, to the indigenous population, again, both within and without the occupied territories.
In this segment, we begin with Nubar Hafsepian describing how the Israelis said their war in Lebanon was one of the most humane in modern warfare.
I want to challenge that humanistic framing that the Israeli-American narrative produced. And I thought the best way to do that, to have an eclectic, purposefully eclectic work, one that A, frames in the first part, the historical context of the Lebanese political system that continually requires the intervention of one power in support of one of the sects or confessions to retain their position of relative power vis-a-vis the confessional order in Lebanon. So we analyzed that, myself and Osama Maqdisi and Dar Ali, the context of the confessional order. The war itself, the causes of the war, well, the first piece that I secured for the book and the shortest piece was also the most poignant by Chomsky. This is a war on Palestine, because it's not a war on a particular geography. It's a war against the idea of resistance in the region as a whole. And the Lebanese, in particular, represented that source of not complying with the dictates of new reordering of the Middle East. Then, from there, I want to cover the war as a lived experience. And there I sought the writings of people who wrote diaries, passionate stories, invoking that this war is a lived experience, and I wanted to show it as a lived experience rather than as an engagement in analysis of strategy and, you know, abstract concepts that eliminate the human factor. In my field of political science, in international relations in particular, we tend to look at wars, but we never look at human beings who are the casualties of wars. Another part of the book, where Gabi's chapter appears, is a selection of Israeli voices. And the unstated claim here, and probably overtly stated claim simultaneously, is that, yes, indeed, there are Israeli voices who speak a voice other than what the official government and the dominant ideological construct evokes, which I find this is important. It brings in a humanistic voice of dissent. And I see myself in the tradition of the oppositional intellectual. The dissenting voices are the ones that imagine the possibilities that the dominant ideologies do not, which is a central theme in Gabi's work, which is in which he actually dedicates it to Edward Said, as he dubs him, the conscious pariah. The conscious pariah being the one who can imagine and articulate alternatives prior to them being dominant ideas. This is a book to deconstruct the reasons of the war. Then I gravitate to looking at international institutions, the denuding of the power of international institutions like the UN, international law, and then we end with a series of looking at the possibilities that this war creates on the economic level. Very technical economic analysis by Zafiris and another person, Sayyid, who work in Beirut with the World Bank on loan to the Lebanese government. And I provide another interesting economic analysis. It's a dry reading, but I thought it was a must. And then I bring in voices from Fawaz Fawzi and Ilyas Khoury and others to show what is the possibilities for change. Now, having said this, there's only one person who turned me down for a piece. The others went above, beyond the call of duty to deliver on time, because we all, I think, felt compelled that we have to do something to at least put out a counter narrative. The end result is that I argue that Hezbollah is not the problem, but it must be part of the solution. For those of you who understand Lebanese politics, here I hearken back to the beginnings of the 1975 civil war. And one of the major mistakes made by the Lebanese progressive forces, presided over by Kamal Jumblat, Walid's father. What Jumblat did, he raised the slogan of the elimination of the Falange from Lebanese politics. What that, in fact, meant and resonated in their neighborhoods was the elimination of the Maronite community, the exclusion of the Maronite community from the political equation. And I think that is deadly, particularly in a society divided in a very intensive confessional sectarian divisions. So I wanted to make sure that whether you are secular or not, and I'm hopelessly secular, and I say that not to use other words, is that Hezbollah cannot be seen as external to what is part of the social fabric and must be dealt with as such. Having said that, I am very critical of Hezbollah. I was one of the few people who actually critiqued it when they invaded Beirut 2 years ago. I didn't buy the argument that a legitimate battle between them and the March 14 movement, their opposition, that is the Hariri-based crowd.
Excuse me, people, when they hear invaded, they think it's violent, so please clarify.
It was violent. People died in the invasion. Of course they did. There was shooting. Beirut was shut down. The barricades were erected for 2-3 days, and then it was quickly resolved. Let me stand by my words, and then we can discuss. Fair enough, right? So, but having said that, the challenge here in Lebanon is that the confessional order, which I started the book with, remains even more entrenched than since the end of the Civil War of 1975 to 1990. The distinctions, the political divisions, have expanded based on the identitarian politics of confessionalism. And one of the reasons for that is the absence of an alternative. The secular idea has not produced tangible political programs on which to coalesce an alternative or a vision of a Lebanon based on citizens rather than members of confessions. And to the present, and we see that in a detail, the inability of the current prime minister to form a government. So he gets appointed, he resigns, he gets reappointed, because that internal division is so great. And it's partially expanded because of the regional impact, the Syria, Iran, Israel. And all three players have a major impact on internal Lebanese, plus obviously the US administration. So we are at a standstill in Lebanon, and part of the reason we are at a standstill is that inevitably, in my mind, there is no internal solution of the Lebanese conflict, short of the regional solution for the Israel-Palestine question. Everything else is affected by that, including the internal Lebanese dynamic. And that's where we stand right now.
Thank you for listening to Radio Tabule, fresh content west of the Middle East. Please support the programs of Levantine Cultural Center with your contributions. Visit levantinecenter.org to learn more about how you can become involved. Radio Tabule produced by Jordan El-Grabli, Jen Reinhardt, and Frieda Becker, with music from Omar Fidel, omarfidel.com.